Hi, this is Newt. 2020 is going to be one of the most extraordinary election years of our lifetime. I want to invite you to join my inner circle as we discuss each twist and turn in the presidential race in my members-only Inner Circle Club. You'll receive special flash briefings, online events, and members-only audio reports from me and my team. Here is a special offer for my podcast listeners. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. And if you sign up for a 1 or 2 year membership, you'll get 10% off your membership price and a VIP fast pass to my live events. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. Use the code podcast at checkout. Sign up today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast and use the code podcast. Hurry, this offer expires February 14th. On this episode of Newt's World, one of the most important struggles on the planet is taking place right now between the people of Hong Kong and the mainland communist Chinese dictatorship led by General Secretary Xi Jinping. It has been 22 years since the July 1st, 1997 handover of Hong Kong from Britain to communist China. The system worked moderately well in maintaining a balance of economic and personal freedom next to a totalitarian system. However, as the Hong Kong government working with Beijing proposed an extradition bill to send lawbreakers in Hong Kong to communist courts in China, millions of Hong Kong citizens flooded the streets in protest. The key test now is what General Secretary Xi Jinping is going to do about this direct confrontation between Hong Kong's people and Beijing's military and police power. On this episode, I'll explain why the protests are happening and why we as Americans should care about the outcome. I really wanted to talk about what's going on in Hong Kong now, because I think that it is the biggest test of the communist Chinese dictatorship since Tiananmen Square in 1989. And the reason I say that is that what you've been watching on television is an outpouring of people. Remember, the Chinese communists have been perfecting visual identification systems, so you can assume that if you're on one of these demonstrations, the odds are pretty good the police are taking your picture. And if they decide to come back and crack down, you could suddenly find yourself in real trouble. The dictatorship on the mainland can be very tough and has had people locked up. So this is not fun and games. This is a real act of courage. And what's fascinating to me is the scale that it's built to, the fact that you and I are watching millions of people who are standing up and saying they don't want to go down a slippery path where the communist government, the dictatorship on the mainland, is able to have greater and greater control. And I think this reflects on something very deep in the Chinese communist dictatorship style. Its court system, in the end, is very political. It's important to remember that the mainland government is, in fact, defined by the Communist Party. It's about 90 million Communist Party members, and that they permeate everything. They permeate the courts, the police, the corporations, the universities. The people in Hong Kong who had spent a long time being governed by the British, who have a totally different approach, very parallel to ours in that the rule of law matters, individual dignity matters, the state has limits on its power. All of those things had conditioned people in Hong Kong to a belief in their own legitimate authority and their own legitimate dignity. And they see all this being threatened, and they're smart enough to understand that it's a slippery slope. The immediate cause of the crisis was a proposed bill that would allow the Chinese Communist government to extradite people from Hong Kong to the mainland. Now, the excuse for it was that a local teenager was killed while she was vacationing with her boyfriend in Taiwan. The boyfriend, who's a Hong Kong resident, admits to the murder, but authorities can't extradite him back to stand trial and they have to prosecute him for a lesser charge of money laundering. So the government comes in using that particular outrageous case as an excuse and says, you know, what we need to do is have an extradition law that in an orderly way will let us get rid of bad people, let us get rid of criminals, violent criminals. And it all sounds on the surface plausible. And you might say to yourself, well, if that's what they're doing, why is there this huge outrage? Why are these enormous demonstrations? And the reason is virtually nobody in Hong Kong trusts the dictatorship in Beijing. And they all assume that once you start down this slope, this year it might be only hardened criminals, next year it might be publishers and writers and public spokespersons, the year after it might be people who belong to parties that are not communist. And so they see it as the beginning of the end of the freedom which has made Hong Kong so unique. You and I have been watching history, and we've been watching a moment in time where we don't know how it's going to end. It could be anywhere from a permanent change in the power system with the people of Hong Kong having vastly more power, or it could be the gradual coercion through a series of steps by Beijing, or it could be that Beijing simply moves in and decides that it's going to do whatever it has to in order to be able to dominate. And the truth is, we don't know which of these outcomes is going to happen next. And that's why I thought it was useful to put in context how Hong Kong got to be there, what it's like, what the fight's over, and what the options are in terms of the central government and what they're looking at. And remember this, if you are the Chinese Communist dictatorship and you're sitting in Beijing trying to run a country of 1,400,000,000 people, you know the deal you've cut, which is the people will give us the right to run a totalitarian state, but in return, we are going to give them prosperity. I think it's fair to say that there's general acceptance in communist China that the deal has been, I have a better life, but that's a life controlled by the Communist Party. But it's better than chaos, it's better than a disaster, it's better than poverty. However, there are three places where there are populations of Chinese descent that are both prosperous and free. The one we're talking about today, Hong Kong, which has a unique relationship in that it is part of communist China, but it is, they say, it's one country with two systems in the 22 years since the British turned over the city-state to the communists, that has actually remained relatively more open, freer, more entrepreneurial, and with greater rights. The second, of course, is Taiwan, which was occupied by the nationalists when they lost the civil war on the mainland, and has grown steadily freer, steadily more open, and steadily more distant from the mainland. Taiwan has millions of people. It's much bigger than Hong Kong. It has millions of people now who are of Chinese descent, but are living in freedom, have a free press, have free elections, and are also very, very prosperous. And the third, of course, is Singapore, which is one of the most remarkable city-states in the world, enormously successful, and which had for a very long time in Lee Kuan Yew, one of the wisest leaders in modern history, who really laid the basis for a remarkably prosperous and safe country. So if you're sitting in Beijing and you're trying to make sure that the 1,400,000,000 people you currently govern don't get crazy ideas, you worry if they start seeing too much freedom in Taiwan or Singapore or Hong Kong, and you worry the most about Hong Kong because it is basically right next to the mainland. People go back and forth all of the time. There's a great deal of news media publishing books and other things in Hong Kong which reach back into China. And so there's a great sensitivity, and they've found themselves, I think, caught and not certain what to do. Next, I'll discuss the history of Hong Kong, including its 155-year British colonization and now 22 years of being under communist Chinese rule. We'll be right back. the struggle underway now between the people of Hong Kong and the communist Chinese dictatorship on the mainland is fascinating in part because Hong Kong has been so amazingly successful. This is a tiny city-state who has $61,000 income per capita, has a population of 7,400,000, one of the most heavily populated places in the world. And it is absolutely an extraordinary achievement of the human spirit that with virtually no resources, virtually no space, that in fact they have built this remarkable trading, finance, and manufacturing center. And that it evolved, as communist China evolved and became more open, Hong Kong had to find new ways of earning a living, new ways of being a competitor worldwide, and they've absolutely done it. It's an astonishing place, and it's a place of great diversity. While about 9 out of every 10 people in Hong Kong are Chinese, there are also Filipinos, there are Indonesians, there are Europeans. The remarkable blend of people is illustrated in their religion. 28% Buddhist or Taoist, about 7% Protestant, about 5% Catholic, about 4% Muslim, about 1.5% Hindu, tiny number of Sikhs, and then people with no stated religion, about half the population. And they feel that they're citizens of Hong Kong. They don't think that they're in any way tied to the Chinese communist dictatorship. In fact, the University of Hong Kong did a study in 2016 and found that only 31% of Hong Kong residents are proud to be national citizens of China. They don't identify their success, their freedom, and their future with the Chinese communist dictatorship. They really see themselves as part of a larger world and as people who make a living by a remarkable level of entrepreneurial behavior. And in fact, there have been a number of studies on the Hong Kong very low tax system in which they have really attracted entrepreneurs, attracted investments, and by allowing people to keep the money they make, they have created a center of wealth. There's an estimate that there are more high-value people in terms of income in Hong Kong than in any other single city in the world. That's how productive and that's how powerful it's been. Now, this is also a historical anomaly. Hong Kong originally was just some islands, and the British decided it was a great port. And so part of the agreement that the British made with the imperial government back at the end of the Opium Wars in the 1840s, they were given rights to the island of Hong Kong. Later on, they acquired rights to an area in the mainland called Kowloon. And for a very long period, the British ran the place with no real regard for the Chinese government, whether it was the Nationalist Chinese or the Communist Chinese, or before that, the Empire. But they ran it as a colony. I think it's important to remember this, because there's a certain amount of unfairness in saying, why can't they have free elections like they did under the British? No, that was a colony. Now, it was a colony that had the rule of law. It was a colony that people generally felt was very fair. It was a colony that was very well policed, but it nonetheless was not a free country. It wasn't a place that had exercised a deep tradition of democracy. This was a 99-year lease, and after a long time, the lease began to run out. And by that time, you had a much bigger, much more powerful communist China, and you had Britain, which had dropped dramatically in military power and dropped dramatically in relative economic rank. And so there was no possibility, no practical, realistic possibility that Britain could hold on to Hong Kong if the Chinese communists weren't in agreement. And so they had a long negotiation. I was actually Speaker of the House in Hong Kong during the negotiating period. And the British worked very hard to get a general agreement from the Chinese communists that they would, in fact, be willing to run a rule of law system very close to what the British had been doing, and that they would gradually bring in some level of representative government. The way the Chinese captured it, and it was a pretty intelligent model, was there would be one country but two systems. So from the standpoint of Beijing, Hong Kong is Chinese, but it's Chinese in a different way than the rest of China. Now, part of the reason that Hong Kong was treated this way is that the dictatorship in Beijing was trying to send a signal to Taiwan that they could rejoin mainland China, and then you would have one country and you'd have three systems. And that required that Taiwan decided that they could trust Beijing to keep its word. So there's a pretty consistent bias in favor of occupying the system in a fair way with the rule of law, with a police force that had a long reputation for being incorruptible and extraordinarily honest and professional. In that setting, Hong Kong just transitioned from Great Britain to China and remained entrepreneurial, had a huge work ethic, people could rise rapidly in economic wealth. And as China grew richer, a great deal of that wealth came through Hong Kong in the form of trade or in the form of finances or insurance companies. And the result was that not only did Hong Kong rise because of itself, but Hong Kong also rose because of the general gradual rise of all of China. So for a very long period, life has been exciting, it's been positive, and yet there's been this continuous sense of being worried about what will happen. And the fact is, nobody knew how it would evolve. Certainly after Tiananmen Square, when the Chinese communists decided they had to shoot people and run over them with tanks, there was a sense that there was a pretty rigid system politically, and it wasn't going to evolve towards any kind of real freedom in the short run. But that didn't particularly carry over to Hong Kong. In fact, Beijing so recognized Hong Kong's ability to be independent that they were willing to have people come to Hong Kong where they could talk about Tiananmen at the very time that in the communist Chinese world, they were erasing all the memories. So if you looked at the history textbooks, if you looked at memoirs, if you looked at a variety of other things, Tiananmen Square never quite occurred in the historic patterns of communist China. But there were people who were openly, publicly talking about it in Hong Kong. The Beijing dictatorship wasn't particularly happy about it, but they gained certain very large advantages by tolerating the way in which Hong Kong operated. First of all, Hong Kong is a generator of enormous wealth, much of which goes to China. The value of Chinese currency, the value of Chinese investments, the very fact that a lot of Chinese wealthy people put money into Hong Kong, all of these things led Beijing to be very careful. They didn't want to kill the goose that was laying the golden egg. At the same time, they also recognized that whatever the political, diplomatic, and public relations hit had been in dealing with Tiananmen Square, it would be enormously bigger if they did something to suppress dissent in Hong Kong itself. I don't think there was ever any serious thought about using the military in Hong Kong the way they had used the military in Beijing. And there's no evidence at the moment, at least, that they are going to put that scale of people in there. And I think they have a pretty good idea how horrible it would look on television and how rapidly the rest of the world would respond with enormous hostility if that's what they did. So you had a situation building where you have, on the one front, the people of Hong Kong pretty aggressively and directly taking on the establishment. And to understand that in part, you have to recognize that that establishment was really rigged by the Chinese communists. There are about 1,200 people who elect the chief executive. Those people are almost overwhelmingly biased in favor of Beijing. There's a general agreement that the amount of pressure that Beijing can bring to bear on the chief executive is overwhelming. And in fact, Lam, who is the current chief executive, couldn't survive for a full day if Beijing wanted to kick her out. People in Hong Kong know this, so they know she's really Beijing's puppet running Hong Kong. She's not Hong Kong's choice running Hong Kong. And that leads to a continuous frustration and a continuous sense of wanting to change it. Now, starting at the end of the British period, there was a growing democracy movement. They had never had full democracy under the British, but they thought now that they were changing over, maybe the time had come to, in fact, have that kind of approach. The tension between the evolution of Hong Kong as an increasingly free environment and the continual effort of the Chinese communists to bring it under a socialist, communist, dictatorial system has been fascinating to watch. 1997, the British leave, the Chinese flag is raised, and the British flag comes down on July 1st, 1997. By 2003, there's an anti-subversion law prohibiting, quote, any act of treason, secession, sedition, or subversion against the central people's government or the theft of the state. So that is actually focused on making them tolerate mainland communist Chinese dictatorship, saying that you can go to jail for doing things that the government in Beijing thinks are inappropriate. But at the time, they're still locked into the Hong Kong legal system. While they tried to ban groups that were unacceptable, they could ban them in the mainland, but they weren't doing a very good job of banning them in Hong Kong. So they kept looking for ways to change the attitude of people in Hong Kong who were very skeptical of the dictatorship and very much in favor of a more open society. By 2012, the government, in desperation, announced a plan to require school children to take classes in Chinese patriotism, by which, of course, they meant the communist dictatorship's patriotism. And there are huge mass student protests, and they don't require it. By 2014, there's a pro-democracy group which actually sets up an unofficial referendum, setting up three different options of how they want to directly elect the head of the local government. Beijing says, no, we're not going to have open nominations. In fact, the Chinese Communist State News Agency reports that candidates would be chosen by a Chinese government committee before being put on the ballot. So they're already narrowing down the range of choices, so you can only pick a choice acceptable to Beijing. When Beijing does reject the proposal for open nominations, there are student boycotts. And all through 2014, you have the police clashing with pro-democracy protesters, hitting them with pepper spray, shooting tear gas, and up to 80,000 people gathered to protest. In 2014, this was considered a substantial protest, 80,000 people. We've just seen 2 million people in the streets. So you can see how the movement has grown over the last 5 years. The Chinese Communist government's chief negotiator, who is now the chief executive officer, Carrie Lam, she's negotiated as long as she can, and they're not going to negotiate anymore. By mid-December, the leaders announced that the boycotts are over. They've made their big push. They failed. And you could have said at that point that that was, up to then, the high watermark of the struggle for democracy in Hong Kong. Even while the political tension was intense, the economic integration continued to go on. By September 2018, there's a high-speed rail link between Hong Kong and mainland China. There are huge quantities of people going back and forth, and you can actually clear communist Chinese immigration inside the station in Hong Kong. However, some of the opposition leaders start saying, wait a second, if you're going to let the Chinese communist government clear immigration in the Hong Kong train station, are you in effect setting up a piece of territory that the Chinese communists will claim is theirs? And so the tension, this very prickly sense of what is it that Beijing's going to try to do next? By September of 2018, not only had they opened a high-speed rail link, but Hong Kong bans the Hong Kong National Party, which had advocated independence for the territory. And they argued that it's a national security issue to have people advocating independence. Well, again, if you think about it, this is a step away from the original vision that they would prove you could have two systems in one country, because increasingly they're coercing people in Hong Kong to basically accept Chinese communist definition of the two systems. And that certainly sends a reminder to Taiwan that maybe you ought to be a little bit careful about how things are going on. They continue, however, economically to work more and more in the direction of coming together. By October 2018, China opens a bridge linking Hong Kong and Macau to the mainland, and General Secretary Xi Jinping presides over the ceremony. So they're gradually having, if you will, golden threads that economically unite Hong Kong and communist China, while they're also slowly trying to crowd out the kind of freedoms that have been integral to living in Hong Kong. So that's what got us to the stage where you had these huge demonstrations. You had Carrie Lam proposed something which clearly had been backed by Beijing, and then she backed down. And we have to presume that she had permission from Beijing to back down, that they looked at a million people in the streets, decided that it was just too big a crowd, and that Hong Kong is too open to television and news media. Therefore, they couldn't continue where they were going. When they backed down on the bill, instead of people going home and saying, great, we won, the next day there were twice as many people in the street, 2 million. Remember, this is in a country in which the entire population is about 7,400,000. So you're talking about almost 30% of the country turning out. And if you take that same number for the U.S., you think about this number, you'll begin to realize how staggering it is. You'd have over 100 million Americans in the street. So in this very congested, very small city state, you had a clear demonstration of massive popularity on behalf of, first, repudiating the extradition bill, and second, having won that fight. Now they were saying, okay, since we got her to back down, let's also fire her. And they're demanding that Beijing allow her to step down. And of course, Beijing doesn't want to do that. And that's why you're now in this very interesting period of a test of will between millions of people in Hong Kong and General Secretary Xi Jinping. Next, why we should all care as Americans about the outcome of the Hong Kong protest. When Neville Chamberlain was contemplating what was happening in Czechoslovakia in 1938, and he was trying desperately to avoid war, he described it as a distant country about which we know little. And of course, the result of that appeasement policy was World War II, because it turned out that that distant country about which we know little was in fact the symbolic breaking point that led Adolf Hitler to believe that he could basically invade any place he wanted to, and Britain and France would tolerate it. Well, Hong Kong is, in the same way, a small city-state, 7,400,000 people. You could argue, what does it matter to us? And what it matters to us is really about the Chinese communist dictatorship more than about Hong Kong. Hong Kong, in a sense, is like the story of the canary in the coal mine. In the old days, they would keep canaries in the coal mine because they were very sensitive to gases. And if the canaries began to get sick, they knew that they had a danger of a gas explosion, and they would evacuate the coal mine. Well, Hong Kong is the testing point for whether or not General Secretary Xi Jinping is willing to allow freedom to evolve, or whether, in fact, faced with the risk of 1,400,000,000 people becoming inspired by Hong Kong, he decides that he has to clamp down and make the dictatorship even tougher, even more repressive, and even more comprehensive. And I think that's why this is a very, very important turning point. And it will be very interesting at the G20 meeting, when the president and Xi Jinping meet, to see what's happened. Do the Chinese communists wait and do nothing until after that meeting? Do they act in advance? And also, how do the people of Hong Kong evolve? They've had a taste now that street power works, pushing to get the chief executive fired. She is Beijing's choice. Beijing's not going to back down very easily. And again, if you think like the leader of 1,400,000,000 people, you don't necessarily want the idea that if enough people go in the street, you're going to do what they tell you. So this is a very delicate and I think very important time, because it affects the largest country in the world. It affects the whole question of whether China evolves in a direction that they become more capable of us working with them, or whether, in fact, in the end, they have to use whatever level of force is needed in order to sustain the dictatorship and maintain the capacity to repress their own people. I think the next few months are going to be very important, and I hope that you get a feel about how remarkable Hong Kong is, what level of courage it took for 2 million people, almost one out of every three citizens of Hong Kong, to go to the streets, and the kind of historic moment when you might in fact see a real step in the direction of freedom, or you might find out that once again repression is used to sustain the dictatorship. I think it will have a big impact on our lives, on how we relate to communist China, and how the system evolves over the next 10 or 15 years. You can read more about the protest in Hong Kong and the relationship between Hong Kong and communist China on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Westwood One. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our editor is Robert Borowski, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. Our guest booker is Grace Davis. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. The music was composed by Joey Salvia. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360 and Westwood One's John Wardock, Tim Sabian, and Robert Mathers. Please email me with your comments at newt@newtsworld.com. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. On the next episode of Newt's World, we're taking an inside look at the spying business through the experiences of 3 career CIA officers.
The number of clear, hard cases of espionage that the Chinese have been involved in has gone up dramatically, and I think it's an evolution of where they are in terms of their relative state power.
I'm Newt Gingrich, and this is Newt's World.
The Westwood One Podcast Network.